Chapter 9. Seeing Red. The political right wants to turn back the clock. On November 1st, 2021, Senator Josh Hawley gave a speech to the National Conservatism Conference. The audience was ready for his standard fare: economic nationalism, patriotism, the power of the free market, and so on. But Hawley surprised them. He focused solely on the problems of men, highlighting some of the challenges I have described here, including in education, employment, and family life. For Hawley, however, these problems are not byproducts of social and economic change. They are the result of a targeted political assault from the left. Hawley described the left's attempt to give us a world beyond men, and declared that the attack on men has been the tip of the spear of the left's broader attack on America. He went on, "The left wants to define traditional masculinity as toxic. They want to define the traditional masculine virtues as a danger to society. Can we be surprised that after years of being told they are the problem, that their manhood is the problem, more and more men are withdrawing into the enclave of idleness and pornography and video games?" Senator Hawley argued that boys and men are struggling because the left hates them. This is a powerful political message, because the first part is true, and the second part can be made to sound plausible given the tendency of many on the left to pathologize masculinity. He got plenty of attention for the speech. But when it came to solutions, Hawley came up largely empty-handed. The best he could offer was a vague promise to restore manufacturing jobs and a marriage bonus in the tax code. He did, however, score a small political victory a few weeks later, leading an 11th-hour move to strike down a provision in the National Defense Authorization Act that would have made women eligible for the military draft. As he said, "It is wrong to force our daughters, mothers, wives, and sisters to fight our wars." By implication, Senator Hawley does not see it as wrong to force our sons, fathers, husbands, and brothers to do so. Conservatives have paid more attention than progressives to the growing problems faced by boys and men, but their agenda turns out to be equally unhelpful. There are three big weaknesses in their approach. First, many conservatives fuel male grievances for political gain, which simply creates more anger and discontent. Second, they overweight the importance of biological sex differences for gender roles, a mirror image of the progressive tendency to dismiss them altogether. Third, they see the solution to men's problems as lying in the past, rather than the future, in the form of a restoration of traditional economic relations between male providers and female carers. Rather than helping men adapt to the new world, conservatives beguile them with promises of the old. This may provide some temporary psychological relief, but we don't need painkillers. We need a cure. Grievance politics. Donald Trump secured the presidency of the United States in 2016 with a 24-point lead among men, the widest gender gap in the half-century history of exit polling. Among white men, who make up a third of the electorate, Trump's margin was 30 percentage points, 62 to 32%. Women tilted towards the Democrats, but only to about the same degree as in previous elections. As the Washington Post reported, "The gender gap widened this year for the same reason Trump took the White House. Men, especially white men, surged right." In the same year, male votes Brexited the UK out of the European Union. The anger fueling populism is about all kinds of things: demographic change, secularization, trade, labor market shocks, and so on. But it is also about gender. Note that even as he lost in 2020, Trump still won most of the male votes and actually increased his support among black and Latino men. When Trump said that it was a very scary time for young men in America, he was scorned by progressives. But it likely resonated with many men and at least some parents. Trump's appeal was a nostalgic one: make America great again. And he found a big political market, the majority of his voters believe that life has gotten worse since the 1950s. And gender plays an important role here. Implicit in the invocation of the past are traditional ideas of femininity and masculinity. One of the most popular t-shirts on sale at his rallies declared, "I support Donald Trump, I love freedom, I drink beer, I turn wrenches, I protect my family, I eat meat, and I own guns. If you don't like it, move." This is about as good a description of the identity of the Trump army as you will find. A pure expression of what Pankaj Mishra described as a form of rearguard machismo. But this is not just found in the US, it's an international phenomenon. Across the world, men have been more likely than women to support right-wing or protest parties. In Sweden, for example, one in four men supported the far-right Sweden Democrats in a 2015 poll, twice the level of support among women. In Germany, especially in the East, men have swung sharply to the political right. In 2017, a third of Saxon men voted for the far-right Alternative for Germany party. "We have a crisis of masculinity in the East, and it is feeding the far right," says Petra Köpping, Minister for Integration in Saxony. In South Korea, young men are also swinging hard right, fueled by anti-feminist sentiment. In the Seoul mayoral election in April 2021, 73% of men in their 20s voted for the conservative candidate, compared to 41% of women in the same age group. The overwhelming support of young men also helped to propel conservative presidential candidate Yoon Suk-yeol to a narrow victory in March 2022. Yoon has promised to abolish the Department of Gender Equality and Family. India's Prime Minister, Narendra Modi, boasts of his 56-inch chest. There was alpha male Imran Khan in Pakistan. As he said, "Feminism has completely degraded the role of mother." Anti-feminist Recep Erdogan, who said women are not equal to men in Turkey, and straight-out misogynist Rodrigo Duterte in the Philippines, who said, "As long as there are many beautiful women, there will be more rape cases." These politicians do not have a thoughtful understanding of male dislocation or any positive remedies. They are simply exploiting it for political purposes. As former Trump advisor Stephen Bannon wrote, "These guys, these rootless white males, have monster power." Some conservatives go as far as to claim that there is a war on men or a war on boys. This language validates and fuels a sense of victimhood. South Korean men in their 20s are now twice as likely to believe that there is more severe discrimination against men than against women. In the US, a third of men of all political persuasions believe that they are discriminated against, and among Republicans, the number is rising. This is false. While the problems of boys and men are real, they are the result of structural changes in the economy and broader culture and the failings of our education system, rather than of any deliberate discrimination. But on the political right, as on the left, attitudes on gender issues float free of the facts. The conservative goal here is to whip up the partisan base in opposition to what Senator Hawley described as the attempt by the left to deconstruct America through an assault on the very idea of gender. One of the data points he used to justify this claim was the inclusion of trans women in competitive female sports. Invoking the threat of transgender rights has now become a standard part of the conservative playbook. Even the question of which bathrooms people use has become a political football. To his credit, Donald Trump answered a question on the bathroom issue in 2016 by saying that trans people should simply use the bathroom that they feel is appropriate. Even though the numbers involved in any of these controversies are tiny, after all, trans people account for just 0.6% of the population, it is an issue that can be weaponized in defense of traditional ideas of sex and gender. Conservative activists see the trans issue as a way to turn the headlights onto what they see as a radical gender ideology, which seeks to entirely erase all biologically based sex differences. Their concern is not really about whether trans people can serve in the military or use the bathroom of their choice. It is about the very idea of clear and separate masculine and feminine categories and characteristics grounded in biology. But they protest too much. The overwhelming majority of people, at least 99%, are cis, identifying themselves as male or female, in line with their natal sex. That some people do not fit into simple binary categories is no threat to the categories themselves. Trans people are rather the exceptions that prove the rule, and both the rule and the exceptions are okay. The good news here is that the general trend is still towards greater inclusion and protection for trans people, especially the landmark Supreme Court decision in June 2021 to secure protection for LGBT people from workplace discrimination under Title VII of the Civil Rights Act. Trump nominee Neil Gorsuch wrote the majority opinion, which was crystal clear. An employer who fires an individual merely for being gay or transgender defies the law. A third gender option, an X, has now been added for US passports. 21 states and DC have done the same for driver's licenses. But it seems clear that many conservatives will likely continue to use the issue of trans rights as a weapon in the broader culture war over sex and gender. Disenchanted men, following the Pied Piper of the internet search algorithm, can be led deeper and deeper into what has been labeled the manosphere, a world of pickup artists, incels, and even some male separatists, MGTOWs, or men going their own way. This is where men who have taken the red pill go to commiserate, organize, and generally hate on feminists. The term red pill, adopted from The Matrix, refers to a choice to see the world as it really is. Here, it means to see that far from being an oppressive patriarchy, our society is actually dominated by feminists seeking to entrap and exploit men. In the more sensible parts of the manosphere, there are debates about real issues facing boys and men, like school discipline, overdiagnosis of ADHD, attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, suicide rates, occupational injury and death, and so on. But it's easy for the disgruntled young man to click on the next video, and the next. In her book, Men Who Hate Women, feminist activist Laura Bates describes the boys who are lost, who fall through the cracks of our society's stereotypes and straight into the arms of the communities ready to recruit them, greedy to indoctrinate them with fears of threats to their manhood, their livelihood. Illegitimate worry or normal anxiety metastasizes into misogyny. Women might come to be seen as psychological prey, to be manipulated into providing sex. This is what it means to be a pickup artist. For the most extreme, the incels, even having to go to the lengths of tricking women into sex seems unfair. Men have a right to sex, they claim, and women have a responsibility to give it to them. The misogyny can seep out of the chat rooms, onto social media, and ultimately even to physical violence. By contrast, MGTOWs don't want to pick up women or harass them online. They want to get away from them altogether. One of the big fears stoked in this community is of a false rape accusation. Better to stay away. There's a helpful hierarchy of MGTOWs, eerily similar to the levels you might find in a computer game. Once a man has taken the red pill and chosen the MGTOW route, the steps are to reject long-term relationships, level one, disavow any sexual relationship or go monk, level two, disconnect from the economy, making only enough to support themselves, level three, and finally, completely disengage from society or go ghost, level four. Many young men dip their toes into some of these waters at some point. It might even have become something of a rite of passage. Some find a genuine sense of community, which may be lacking in their offline life. But the overwhelming majority grow out of it. Very few end up acting out in one terrible way or another. Underneath it all is a deep well of confusion and disorientation, which, as always, somebody is willing to exploit. I'm not saying that Hawley or other populist conservatives are to blame for the rise of these online manosphere movements. If anything, progressives have more to answer for here, by either neglecting male issues altogether or by blaming them on toxic masculinity. But what Hawley shares with these communities is a reactionary worldview, a belief that the only way to help men is by restoring traditional gender roles and relationships. They want the old world back, one in which men and women know their place. But our solutions are not to be found in the past. Lobsters against equality. In 2016, just as Donald Trump was defying almost every political prediction to win the 2016 election, a Canadian psychologist broke out of academic obscurity to become, according to George Mason economist and podcaster Tyler Cohen, the most influential public intellectual in the Western world right now. Respected among scholars for his work on personality traits, Jordan Peterson came to fame for refusing to use the preferred pronouns of a transgender student in protest of new Canadian laws on trans rights. His 2018 book, 12 Rules for Life, based on a Quora post and accompanied by a global speaking tour, sold more than 5 million copies. For anyone serious about understanding what is happening with young men, Peterson's appeal is an important data point. By Peterson's own reckoning, they account for 80% of his audience. Men flock to him because, unlike so many, he does not mock or patronize them. He makes them feel heard. Peterson stumbled across a gigantic reservoir of unmet human need. His genuine compassion for the plight of young men marks him out from the people of the left who want to excoriate them and the people on the right who want to exploit them. He's a genuine intellectual wrestling with real and important issues. But like many conservatives, he also sets too much store by biology. Like all successful modern public intellectuals, Peterson has an online merch store, selling not only books but stickers, socks, and framed art. There is also a special lobster section, featuring t-shirts and hoodies covered with small red images of Peterson's favorite crustacean, including now, of course, a lobster-dotted face mask. Among Peterson fans, the lobster has become a sign of tribal loyalty. You're probably wondering why. Lobsters exist in hierarchies, he explains. They have a nervous system attuned to the hierarchy, and that nervous system runs on serotonin, just like our nervous systems do. And the nervous system of the lobster and of the human being is so similar that antidepressants work on lobsters. One of the main planks of Peterson's philosophy is that social hierarchies are part of the natural order. Mammals are wired to know their place. But the science here is not very good. Lobsters don't actually have brains, it turns out. For what it's worth, I think his use of lobsters is better seen as simply part of his storytelling style. I see Peterson as the latest incarnation of the mytho-poetical strand of the men's movement, which uses allegory, in his case of lobster societies, to evoke an older, deeper form of masculinity. Robert Bly's Iron John, a bestseller in 1990, offered a similar prospectus, arguing that men had been over-domesticated into soft men and needed to rediscover the hairy man within. In his 1996 book, Transforming Men, British sociologist Jeff Dench casts men as frogs, making their way through forests in search of a princess. Dench, Bly, and Peterson all write a lot about witches and whales and castles and towers and kings. This should not be a surprise. Bly was a poet, and Peterson's earlier book, Maps of Meaning, is a dense, well-regarded academic study of mythology. If it was just the lobsters, Peterson's overweighting of biology would not matter too much. Unfortunately, it also distorts his views on gender. He points out that women are more agreeable and conscientious than men, more into people, and more nurturing. Men are more aggressive, status-conscious, driven by sex. This is all true. The real question is how far these differences can be relied on to explain gender inequalities in current societies. For Peterson, it seems, a great deal. While progressives make the mistake of denying any biological basis for sex differences, conservatives like Peterson, and he's quite representative in this regard, make the opposite error of explaining away current gender inequalities with an appeal to nature. They end up justifying disparities that are much too wide to be attributed to natural causes. The question of occupational choice is a good example. In an interview, Peterson said that men and women won't sort themselves into the same categories if you leave them to do it of their own accord. So far, so good. But he then went on to say that ratios of 20 to 1 of men to women in engineering and the other way around in nursing are a consequence of the free choice of men and women. Those are ineradicable differences. When Petersonian conservatives see that only 15% of engineers are women and only 9% of nurses are men, they see nothing more than a reflection of natural sex differences. These are much higher proportions, after all, than 1 in 20. But remember that study by Sue and Rounds that I cited in Chapter 7, showing that if occupational choices actually matched underlying preferences, there would be at least twice as many female engineers and male nurses. There's also a danger that sex differences in nurturing behaviour are used to justify a traditional division of labour in terms of family life. Peterson has urged that we stop teaching 19-year-old girls that their primary destiny is a career. Things become trickier still when it comes to specific policies. Conservative scholar Charles Murray describes the evidence on sex differences between men and women in his book Human Diversity. It's a thorough, mostly balanced summary. The problem comes when he uses these data to justify sexist policies. Laws governing child custody are a good case in point. Murray argues that by any measure of which sex is better at nurturing young children, there is a big effect size favouring females and an overwhelming evolutionary case that the female advantage is grounded in biology. He argues that courts should therefore default to maternal custody of young children instead of the current legal default to consider the best interests of children on a case-by-case basis. As Murray writes, where judges are faced with no clear evidentiary basis for favouring one parent over another and a helpless third party's welfare is at stake, a principled liberal position can acknowledge an important innate difference between men and women. This is wrong. If a judge really has no clear evidentiary basis of a difference in the parenting abilities of two separating parents, granting custody to one of them based solely on their sex is arbitrary and unfair. Murray marshals evidence for a real average difference in some aspects of parenting abilities to argue for the incorporation of a sexist principle into family law. Fathers are struggling to retain their role as it is, and Murray's proposal would make matters worse. He makes similar arguments with regard to women serving in military combat roles, and was no doubt pleased by Senator Hawley's success in preventing women being added to the draft. The broader problem here is that conservatives justify gender inequalities with biological explanations that are not wrong, just too thin to bear the weight they put on them. Of course, conservative arguments for the importance of biology in human behaviour seem more reasonable when their opponents deny their existence altogether. It is hard to see how much someone is exaggerating the truth when their principal antagonists deny the truth altogether. This is one of the most unfortunate dynamics in the culture wars over sex and biology. The more fervently the left denies any innate sex differences, the more strongly many on the right feel the need to insist on their importance, and vice versa. The room for nuance becomes smaller. Forward to the past. The final and most serious mistake made by conservatives is their assumption that the only way to help boys and men is to restore traditional gender roles, which means reversing some of the gains made by women in terms of economic independence. In this zero-sum world, if women are doing better, that must be why men are doing worse. This is not a fringe opinion. Almost 2 out of 5 Republican men, 38%, agree with the statement that The gains that women have made in society have come at the expense of men. In a fascinating study conducted before the 2016 election, Dan Cassino, a professor at Fairleigh Dickinson University, added an unusual question to a survey of voting intentions. Do you earn more, less, or about the same as your spouse? Half the respondents got the question early in the survey, before being asked about voting, and the other half got it after declaring their voting intention. The question was intended to prime men, as Cassino writes, to think about potential threats to their gender roles. The results were striking. Men asked the question about spousal earnings early in the survey were much more likely to say they would vote for Donald Trump than Hillary Clinton. This was a small poll of around 700 registered voters, but Cassino's experiment hints at the potential for politicians to activate and exploit male anxiety about the loss of status. The argument made by many conservative intellectuals is that if men lose their traditional role, they will become detached from society or start to act out. The monster power, Bannon observed, gets channeled into antisocial behaviour. This is not a new concern. Conservatives have been worrying about the dangers posed to men by the women's movement for decades. In his 1992 book, Men and Marriage, an update of his 1973 book, Sexual Suicide, conservative intellectual George Gilder argued that feminism would render men redundant. Once women were able to be both provider and procreator, he warned, the need for marriage to a man would decline, leaving them as either outlaws or exiles. Younger listeners may be unfamiliar with Gilder's work, but among feminists of a certain age, his name provokes a strong reaction. Gilder went on to influence Ronald Reagan's economic policies and was proud to have been named Male Chauvinist Pig of the Year by both Time magazine and the National Organization of Women. There is much to dislike about Gilder's worldview, but here's the thing, he wasn't completely wrong. Like most of the anthropologists I cited back in Chapter 7, including Margaret Mead, Melvin Connor, David Gilmour, and Sherry Ortner, Gilder saw the fragility of the male role. As he wrote, "Unlike a woman, a man has no civilized role or agenda inscribed in his body. The man's role in the family is thus reversible. The woman's is unimpeachable and continues even if the man departs. A man without a woman has a deep inner sense of dispensability." Writing along similar lines, Jeff Dench identified the fundamental weakness of feminist analysis as a failure to see that men may need the status of the main provider role to give them a sufficient reason to become fully involved and stay involved in the longer-term draggy business of family life. Conservatives are right to worry about the dangers of anomie and detachment among men stripped of their traditional role, but they are wrong to think that the solution is to somehow turn back the clock, making women dependent again in order to resupply men with purpose. For all the hankering after an imagined past, fewer than 1 in 5 Americans, 18%, said in 2012 that women should return to their traditional roles in society, down from 30% in 1987, according to Pew's Social Values Survey. And on this question, there are, unusually, no major differences by sex, age, political inclination, or race. The conservative claim is that feminism has upended the natural order of things, and we are all, but men especially, paying the price. The restoration of traditional families and roles is the answer. This analysis is wrong. Feminism has upended patriarchy, a specific social order that had the fatal flaw of being grossly unequal. The resulting disruption is real and must be taken seriously. Men do need help, but we can help men without hindering women or trying to turn back the clock. Fatherhood, in particular, can be reinvented for a more egalitarian world. As Arthur Schlesinger wrote in a 1958 essay titled The Crisis of American Masculinity, "The key to to the recovery of masculinity does not lie in any wistful hope of humiliating the aggressive female and restoring the old masculine supremacy. Masculine supremacy, like white supremacy, was the neurosis of an immature society. It is good for men, as well as for women, that women have been set free. In any case, the process is irreversible. That particular genie can never be put back into the bottle. If that was true in 1958, it is obviously dramatically more so today. That is why it's so unhelpful to suggest that we can turn back the tide. Rather than helping boys and men in the difficult task of adapting to the new world of equality, conservatives encourage them to resist women's progress. Resistance may feel good, at least for a while, better perhaps than the demanding task of adaptation. But it is also futile and pointless. Centrifugal gender politics. Roles are changing for both men and women. Women are being pressured to believe that their past status was brought about by male oppression, writes one astute cultural observer who goes on, at the same time, men are being accused of being oppressors, and angry oppressors at that. The whole process of change is taking place in an atmosphere of the greatest bad temper, and a tremendous amount of secondary hostility is being generated that in itself poses a threat to a good outcome. That was Margaret Mead in 1975. The hostility remains, despite the extraordinary successes of the women's movement. Our politicians must shoulder much of the blame here. The failure of both left and right to respond to the growing problems of boys and men has created a dangerous vacuum in our political life. In the centrifugal dynamic of culture war politics, the more the right goes to one extreme, the more the left must go to the other, and vice versa. The left dismisses biology. The right leans too heavily on it. The left sees a war on girls and women. The right see a war on boys and men. The left pathologizes masculinity. The right pathologizes feminism. Meanwhile, far away from the front lines of the culture war, the real world problems of boys and men go largely unaddressed. And the stakes here are high. As Daniel Schwamenthal, director of the American Jewish Committee's Transatlantic Institute, says, the iron rule of politics is that if there are real problems in society and responsible parties don't deal with them, the irresponsible parties will jump on them.